'cause she's so good to me. And I'm bound to come out on top. That's where she said I should be. I will hear every word the boss may say, for he's the one who hands me down my pay.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is John Schmidt, who's a senior economist with the Center for Economics and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. He has co-authored with Lawrence Michel and Jared Bernstein three editions of The State of Working America. And his research is focused primarily on inequality in the U.S. labor markets and the role of labor market institutions in explaining international differences in economic performance, particularly between the United States and Europe. Welcome to Background Briefing, John Schmidt.
Thank you.
And the Bureau of Labor Statistics just announced that the union membership in the United States has reached an all-time low. Is that right, an all-time low?
At least since we've been taking a careful measure of the unionization rate since basically the end of World War II to the present, it is the lowest rate we've been at, yep.
And just give us the figures then.
Well, right now, about 11.3% of the workforce is a union member. That's down from, say, about 20-25% through the 1970s. And if you go back to the peak, it was probably about a third of all workers in the 1950s. So it's a big fall from the 1950s. It's a smaller fall, but still a steep drop from the, say, the late 1970s, and it is an ongoing trend.
So it's basically, in a year, has it gone down from 6.9% of the public sector? Well, no, this is the private sector. So it's gone down from 6.9 to 6.6%?
That's right. There's a big difference in the U.S. data between what's happening in the public sector and what's happening in the private sector. If you go back for the last 30 years, the unionization rate in the public sector has held pretty solid between 35 and 40% from the end of the 1970s to the present. It goes up and down a little bit, but it's always been in that range. But over that same period, as I was saying, the unionization rate in the private sector has been falling pretty steadily, and that's pulling down the overall numbers. The numbers in the public sector have been pretty solid for three decades. The numbers in the private sector have been falling very steadily for the last three decades and even from before then, and that's pulling down the overall numbers.
But since the recession, the numbers in the public sector, unionized numbers, has gone down. Hasn't it gone down because largely there's been an assault on the public unions by a lot of Republican governors?
At the national level, if you look at the data, there's definitely been a big drop this past year in the unionization rate in the public sector. It's fallen from about 37% of public sector workers to 35.9%. Now, that is a bigger drop than we normally see, though numbers there tend to fluctuate a couple of a tenth of a percent or a half a percentage point, so a 1.1 percentage point drop is a big one. It's a little too early to tell exactly what's causing it, but I think leading suspects have to be exactly what you're talking about, that there has been some payoff to the Republican attacks on the unions to the people who have been leading those attacks, obviously at the expense of public sector union workers.
Now, what have been the effects then of these right-to-work measures in various states, the most recent one of which, of course, was Michigan, that was again somewhat like what happened yesterday in Virginia with a stealth attack on redistricting. The Republicans slipped through a bill. They did the same thing up in Michigan, a right-to-work bill, which the governor, even though there was a lot of pressure against it, has signed. So give us a sense of that. Again, we've seen how the attack on public employee unions by the Republicans, and particularly in Wisconsin with Governor Scott Walker, has had an effect on the amount of union workers in the public sector, which has gone down. How much has this right-to-work legislation in various states affected the private sector unionization?
Well, I think it's too early to tell exactly how and what the impact will be of some of the measures you just mentioned in terms of what's happening, say, in Michigan very recently in the data that we currently have. But we can put the current private sector numbers into some perspective if you think about the comparison with the public sector. And the biggest difference between the public sector and the private sector is that there is ferocious employer opposition to unions in the private sector, and the labor law in the private sector works very strongly against workers forming a union or getting a collective bargaining agreement. So it takes makes it much more difficult for private sector workers. And as I was saying before, if you look over the last 30 years, the public sector unionization rate has, until this past year, managed to hold fairly steady. And even the drop this year, it's too soon to know whether that's a long-term trend or whether it's just a one-year change. But the public sector workers have been able to maintain a very high level of unionization relative to the private sector because they're not subject to the kind of ferocious employer opposition, and they operate in a context, a legal context, where it's much easier to form a union. It's very hard in the private sector to form a union, to maintain a union, to get a collective bargaining agreement. And that, I think, is what we're seeing in these numbers. This long-term decline is because the private sector workforce has been essentially deprived of its rights to collective bargaining because of the way employers take advantage of the laws that we have. And you see that in contrast in the public sector, where you don't have a level of employer opposition and where you have a legal structure that's more welcoming, conducive to unionization, at least historically, we have a much higher unionization rate. The big development in the last couple of years is that Republican governors in particular have started to try to take the tactics that the private sector has used against unions in the private sector and put them into the public sector context.
So why is America unique in its hostility to unions? The Europeans, I imagine, and you've done a lot of work, John Schmidt, on the differences between economic performances, particularly between the United States and Europe, in regard to the role of labor and labor markets. First of all, in other European and advanced democracies, the labor parties tend to have closer ties with unions, as opposed to the Democratic Party that used to have closer ties with the unions. And then under Clinton and others, it sort of moved towards Wall Street in the search of more money, I take it. And the labor unions don't have the influence that they had. That maybe is one factor. My other understanding is, for example, in Germany, which has the most successful economy in the world and in a very, very effective export economy, they have, I think, 50% of the seats on the board of directors of these big companies belong to union representatives, and that's apparently a law. So there is a lot of, obviously, reasons for why the Europeans have a more labor representation, but it doesn't explain the hostility. And where does that come from?
Well, that's a very big, deep question, and it's hard, I think, to completely understand what the motivation is. But the one thing that I would say is that the United States historically has had much higher unionization rates than we currently have, and unions played a much more central role in our politics, in our economic system, and in our social system, in terms of supporting a lot of long-term progressive changes in this country. So I think to say that we're uniquely hostile to unions is, I think, not. There's an element of truth there, but there's also a long-standing historical experience we have of unionization in this country. A comparison I find particularly useful is between the United States and Canada. If we have very similar economies. We have not in terms of size, but in terms of the kinds of activities that we do here. We have a similar standard of living. And if you look at the data, as my colleague Chris Warner has done, for unionization in Canada versus the United States, they track each other very closely in the 1920s, the 1930s, 50s, 60s, and into the 1970s. And then suddenly, Canada maintains a high level of unionization about where the United States was, a little bit ahead of where we were, and the United States starts to plummet. And I think the key difference there is, Canadians, as I said, have a similar kind of economy, similar reliance on foreign trade, even more than we do. They have a similarly well-educated workforce. The big difference was that Canadian labor law is much more conducive to unions forming and getting a first contract. In the United States, we have a legal system that is very hostile to unions, and you can see it in the numbers, this big divergence. Canada has more or less held steady. They've lost a little bit of union membership in the last few years, but compared to the United States, this wide gap has opened up, and I really think it has to do with the legal framework that we have here.
Well, but the legal framework comes out of politics, doesn't it? If you go back to the Taft-Hartley Act, one of the things that it did, which I think really crippled the union movement in this country, was it banned secondary strikes. And in almost every other advanced democracy, when unions go on strike, their brothers and sisters in other unions join them, and therefore they become incredibly effective. So by passing that law, which was passed some time ago, making secondary strikes illegal, they really did undercut the leverage of unions in terms of strikes.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. And you are making an extremely important point, which is that legal framework does come straight out of a political context. And I think it goes back to a point you were making earlier, which is there is a much stronger set of ties between the social democratic parties in Europe and their labor movements. That, of course, has broken down a lot in the last 15 or 20 years with the rise of, say, New Labor in Britain, or with the rise of their kind of counterparts in the French Socialist Party or in the German Social Democratic Party. And, you know, meanwhile, in the United States, I think that the role and the strength and the weight of the union movement in the 50s, 60s, and 70s in the Democratic Party was stronger than it is now, but it was never at the same level that European unions had within their left parties.
But what about the point I was making earlier about Germany having representatives of unions on the boards of directors of major companies? And it seems to have, in part, contributed to Germany's incredibly robust economy and the world's leading export economy. Is there a connection there?
I think that there is a connection, but I think it also illustrates the other point you were making, which is that there is a political context that leads to an institutional setup where unions have representation on the boards. The one thing I would say in terms of Germany, which I do think in terms of standard of living for working people is one of the highest in the world, if not the highest, the one thing that I would say is that since unification in particular, there has been a big push from the center-right and the left-wing party, the Social Democratic Party within Germany has participated in this in terms of restructuring the labor market to make it the people euphemistically call more flexible, which means it's easier to get rid of workers, it's easier to put workers on temporary contracts, it's easier to contract out. The unionization coverage rate in Germany has fallen a lot in the last 15 or 20 years, I think hugely to the detriment of the functioning of the economy. The economy is doing well despite that. But there are a lot of pressures, even in some of these much more successful economies, towards doing the kinds of things that we've done in the United States that essentially redistribute income upwards for the benefit of a relatively small share of the population.
Well, just to return to our economy here, John Schmidt, again, senior economist with the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C., and he, along with Lawrence Michel and Jared Bernstein, are the co-authors of three editions of The State of Working America, and his research focuses primarily on inequality in the U.S. labor market and the role of labor market institutions in explaining international differences in economic performance, particularly between the United States and Europe. Clearly, the public sector layoffs that have happened since the meltdown on Wall Street in 2008 have been a major drag on our economic recovery. And of course, that's a part of the general Republican thrust towards austerity in the name of deficit reduction. That's the excuse. But there seems to be a broader excuse for why American workers are doing poorly and, in fact, doing worse. And the private sector unionization has dropped from 6.9 to 6.6 in just 1 year. It seems to me that this new hoax, globalization, has become an excuse, a very convenient excuse for American capitalists to downsize their workers. And their excuse being that, well, I'm sorry, we can't pay you more wages. Wages have been flat since the 1970s because there's a new economic environment out there. You know, you're competing with Sri Lanka and Bangladesh now.
Yeah, I'm always amazed by those kinds of arguments because people are basically saying we're being told by people pushing kind of NAFTA-style agreements and even worse than NAFTA-style agreements that the only way we can become prosperous or maintain our national prosperity is by engaging in these particular, you know, deals, which I'm reluctant to call trade deals because a lot of them have very little to do with trade, and they have a lot more to do with things like investor rights. They have a lot more to do with things like copyright and patent protections, all sorts of things that have very little to do with foreign trade in a direct sense. But the point is, the argument is made that these trade deals are crucial to maintaining our prosperity, and yet we're also told at the same time, in the, practically the same breath, that now that we're involved in these trade deals and now that we're involved in this globalization process, we can no longer afford to pay people what we used to pay them. So if the point of these things is to make us richer, I don't understand why we all have to earn less and have fewer benefits. You know, it really raises the direct question of, well, you know, why are we bothering to do these things? You know, wouldn't we just be better off if we didn't do it? And, you know, we don't get an answer to that question. We're not told, well, why don't we just sit this one out?
Well, I thank you so much for joining us here today, John Schmidt.
Great, thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with John Schmidt, who's a senior economist with the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. He has co-authored with Lawrence Michel and Jared Bernstein three editions of The State of Working America, and his research is focused primarily on inequality in the U.S. labor market and the role of labor market institutions in explaining international differences in economic performance, particularly between the United States and Europe. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. And you can also contact us at facebook.com/IanMastersMedia. And I'll be back again tomorrow at 5 p.m. with another background briefing. Bye for now. Down in America, the guy that lived next door in 305.